right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we got a hell of a show today, actually. We're going to start off with something that's very important. We're going to be talking with Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City. And we're going to be talking about November 4th, It Begins. That's right. And I will get back to that in just a minute. But in the second part of the show, we're going to be talking with writer George Prochnick. He's a writer for The New Yorker. And about 6 months ago, he wrote a really powerful piece about Stefan Zweig and his whole analysis of fascism and when it's too late to stop fascism. And it really has a lot of lessons for us to pay attention to today. So stay tuned for that one. Right now, what I want to do is I want to make sure that we have enough time to get into this with Andy Z. And as always, as I said, I'm very pleased to get into to have Andy on the show. And in just this last week, the Trump regime has moved to the further restriction of abortion rights, birth control, civil rights of transgender people and others. Trump's made ominous threats of war against North Korea and Iran. He's tearing up treaties and openly scorning the norms of diplomacy. And Refuse Fascism recently said, every day, the Trump-Pence fascist regime is showing us what they stand for. It's our responsibility to drive them from power. And as I said, one of the initiators of the Refuse Fascism movement is Andy Z. Andy, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this. It's been a hell of a week, a hell of a couple weeks. We have about 3 weeks before November 4th. And on November 4th, we've talked about there needs to be thousands of people across the country stepping out and opening up. Be the opening squad of a movement determined to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. What does that give people, just so we can give people sort of the overall picture of what we're talking about happening that day? Let's just talk about that and why it's imperative, and then we'll get into some particulars in terms of building for it.
Well, Michael, what you just said is it gets to the necessity for this. Literally every day we see some new measures from this regime, and we have to understand that and I think people feel this in their hearts, they worry about this, that the Trump-Pence regime poses the potential for a real catastrophe for humanity, if not the elimination of humanity. His threats, particularly in relationship to Iran and North Korea, hold the very real danger of a nuclear war, which could be a catastrophe beyond what people could imagine. And so beginning on November 4th, everyone, every day, and everywhere need to start protesting in different ways every day until our basic demand is met, that this nightmare must end and the entire Trump-Pence regime must go. This is a demand that we actually have to bring before people. It means that we have to understand that it's the responsibility of the people to drive these folks from power. This means working and organizing with all of our creativity so that on November 4th, we begin with many thousands of people in Los Angeles, the Bay Area, New York City, Chicago, and I think there's about 13 cities who've listed protests already. But we have to make a beginning so that people see there is another way to go at this beyond wishing and hoping and working for things that could indeed end up being too late to drive this regime from power.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at some of these recent developments, some of the things that you're talking about regarding Trump. I mean, it's been very heavy for people, I think, to look at this and try to, I mean, there's a lot of people, I think, that are trying to figure this out. I know talking to neighbors and friends and, you know, this kind of thing of people trying to figure out, well, what's going on? You know, one guy was talking to me yesterday about this. He came up and he said, look, there's an open rift between Trump and the key members of you know, the people he's got around him, Tillerson incident, Mattis, you know, and all these seeming differences around Korea and Iran. And some people are summing up this is the regime getting a little tipsy, that contradictions are emerging. And I think there's really a lot of people trying to wrestle with what's the significance of this? Is the regime starting to wobble or what?
No, well, I think what people are seeing is that there's acute struggle to impose and to implement fascism, which is to say there's an acute struggle over having what governs in America, what are the norms of America's role in the world, what is norms of American society, be radically transformed in ways that are extremely dangerous. And, look, from my perspective, America has been a horror for masses of people here and around the world since its inception. But there's many people who also experience that every day. In fact, a great number of people, black, brown people in the United States, LGBTQ people, women in a certain, women to a large degree, and we've seen some of this come out now, and people around the world. But there are also many, many people here who haven't seen that and who believe at least in the promise of America. But I think everybody recognizes that what's going on with the Trump-Pence regime is something that's radically different in a very bad and dangerous way for the people of the world and for this country, that it's a change that in how things have been. And in fact, one of the things that people get confused by is that the cable TV and the media and a lot of the websites constantly talk about how Trump is not doing things the way they're supposed to be done, which is actually precisely the point. He's not doing things the way things have been done because he and the people who have backed him see the necessity from their point of view that no longer can we actually have a multicultural society to the degree that that has even existed, even with all the mass incarceration, police murder, and all the rest of the systemic white supremacy that has been around for a long time. But the Trump regime represents a different synthesis of this. It's saying, to hell with all of that. We're not going to do that anymore. The same thing with international relations. So he was able to bring on board into his cabinet a group of fascists combined with a group of reactionaries who more or less thought this agenda was the right way to go. But some of them, they all had differences and come out of, in some senses, different parts of these fascistic and right-wing movements. And as Trump is moving ahead, including with his recklessness and probably a certain degree of his psychosis, which is not the essence of it, but part of it, and it's exactly, you need that kind of guy to rule this kind of, to bring about something like fascism, that there's contradictions that have emerged. But they are both right now sticking with him, and they're also stuck with him. And in the end of the day, they're actually all for this. Look, when Trump said at the United Nations that we would totally destroy North Korea, that was a speech that was vetted by his administration. That was not a surprise. I mean, there are some people saying that he didn't actually have total destroy in the draft, but the essential message of that speech was approved by all these people, and they're still standing behind it. And so we have to understand and look at the differences among them in that context. And if some back away from the program or get cold feet, then he'll replace them with other people. The fact is the agenda is moving forward and they will not stop it. And the idea that the regime will implode is a very dangerous idea and a foolish one and doesn't correspond to what's actually happening. In fact, what's principally happening is he's moving ahead with his agenda. People are becoming inured to it or normalizing it. And what's really needed is for people to take these matters into our own hands, which is the point of what starts on November 4th.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking as you were talking, you know, that's exactly the point that has been just sort of like driving at me for a while in terms of reading all this stuff and looking at, you know, just examining different people's comments and their take on stuff. And there is this point about no matter what, you know, for all these people that have different ideas about whether it's we just got to get through the, you know, if we can get to the, you know, the midterm elections and we change some things and we change the balance of power in the Congress and whatnot, we can actually, maybe we can do something. We can create some public opinion. Get this stuff going, you know, keep the people that are, you know, the Democrats that are willing to fight in office and get rid of the ones that aren't and get better ones in there. There's all the stuff. And then there's things about people just not knowing what the hell to do. And so, but it seems like what you're saying is that there's actually a method to Trump's madness, that he sees his path as an imperative. And that actually leads to, you know, a whole, you know, and he does these things. I mean, he does all these things that actually, you know, that people look at and they might think, Jesus, this guy's just crazy. Look at the stuff he does, like that whole thing about Puerto Rico in the big puddle of water and a big ocean surrounded by an ocean. And, you know, and at the same time as he's doing, as he's putting on the Looney Tunes part, he's also out there doing these like terrible things, both, you know, the recent developments in his, what he's doing in Puerto Rico and what's coming clear about what he's doing in Puerto Rico, what he's said about, you know, the Middle East, what he, you know, all of these things that where he's pushing us, Iran, all this stuff where Korea, North Korea, there's all this stuff that's really being put out. And this is the imperative of his path is actually driving him in this way. It does have some kind of, I mean, how do you think the impact of that is? Let's examine that a little bit more. You started on this, but the impact of that on what people think is necessary, what they think is possible. There's necessary and then possible, too.
Okay, well, you raised a lot of things in your comments.
I know.
So let's take it apart. Well, why don't we just, I would like to say something about Puerto Rico.
Good.
First, and then get to the point of what is the problem with, and why can we not rely on the 2018 congressional elections to redress this situation, to change it back to one where we're not in imminent danger of a full consolidation of fascism. But if you look at Puerto Rico, look, just let me back up even one more second. Trump is who he is. This guy has been a white supremacist fascist, and that the fact that he's a madman and a white supremacist is part of what you need for to be that kind of, that's the kind of person who will break, who will shatter the mold. And I was mentioning that Duterte and Hitler, Mussolini, these are all people who they are, but then they get backed. And it's very clear that this, while this might have shocked even the Republican establishment, which is a very fascistic establishment anyway, that it may have shocked them that Trump won, is because the fact is he won is he was actually the person who could actually deliver on the very programs that these other folks keep advocating but not being able to implement. But on Puerto Rico, I mean, I think there you really had it right there. Is so much of its evidence, the white supremacy, you know, that basically it's Donald Trump to Puerto Rico, drop dead. And look, we can't accept a genocide, and that's what that is. Even that's what's going on here. People are dying. There's 200,000 meals a day they're delivering to Puerto Rico, and there's about 2 million people who have to be fed. There's lack of medicine. There's lack of all this. And Trump's basically said, oh, this is your own fault, which is a classic racist comment. We're not going to keep supporting you. Even today's New York Times, you can look at an op-ed from Krugman. And, you know, he does a thing there on, you know, that an area has been devastated and the Iowa has been devastated and the government's going to provide people with lots of aid. And then he says, well, actually, it's not Iowa, it's Puerto Rico. And that tells you what you need to know, because it's Puerto Rican, Hispanic, Latino, brown people. This is why he's not actually supporting. So, yes, there's the idiocy and the lunacy of being amazed that an island is surrounded by lots of water. But beneath all that is actually a very deep racism, white supremacy, and a program that says we are not going to do that anymore. This is a genocidal aspect, not only in relationship to Puerto Rico, but also in relationship to every other group that's been targeted by this regime.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Z from Revolution Books. Andy is also one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org, and he's been very active in exactly that, fighting to refuse fascism. Well, we were talking about, you know, sort of there's an impact that all this has had on the people and in terms of how people are looking at what's the way to resolve all this, you know,
So there's the question of 2018, mm-hmm. and elections and we're the majority. So can't we, shouldn't we just sort of tough this out? We've been through bad times before, bad administrations, certainly black and Latino people have lived generations in their entire existence in this continent have been one of exploitation and oppression. So why can't we just get through this? And the fact that we're a majority mean we can take back the House of Representatives, and then that would give us the potential of impeachment, I suppose. I guess that's what the logic is. But the problem with that is you know, I would say people who do think that's the solution should get themselves into the streets beginning November 4th, because if you really want to move that movement forward, you actually, that's only going to be fueled by a right protest in the streets. And I think history will bear that out. But more to the point, the problem is when we're talking about what he's threatening in North Korea or with Iran, or even right now, the lives of the people of Puerto Rico, is that we can't wait till then. It's a height of complacency, actually, to say, well, here's what it is, but we'll have this chance 2 years later. This has to change now, and there has to be the kind of upsurge and crisis in society that's caused by millions of people out in the street, ultimately day after day, that would force some of these people who are in Congress and elsewhere, who are in some opposition to, or people who sort of represent the old order, which, again, I have my criticism of, and I think people should look into the history of this country and present reality and see that that in itself isn't the best that humanity could do. But nonetheless, these people will only be compelled to act if, indeed, there's millions of people in the street. But even further, if you drill down even more, and I think people know this on one level, that the Republicans have already, and they will continue to rewrite the voting laws to disenfranchise whole sections of the people who would be in opposition to them. And there's no reason to believe that somebody like a Donald Trump and the people he's assembled and the sycophants in Congress are not going to actually would not actually extend that, and in an emergency situation could simply suspend the Constitution and all kinds of other things, and certainly limit the ability for people to vote things out. But my main point is it could become too late, both for in terms of being able to vote around it, but more, there could be a catastrophe for humanity that happens soon. And if you really think about this situation with the bellicosity, the threats against North Korea, there could be just a cataclysm very soon, and that is intolerable when we know it's a potential. Everybody can sense that that's a potential, and so there we do need to act on that now.
Mm-hmm. And that definitely is the weight that actually is weighing down on a lot of people. And then there's the point that what's been being put forward by Refuse Fascism, which is extremely important. I mean, the call for a massive campaign in the streets and everywhere. I mean, I've talked to people in the arts out here, you know, who are just like really excited about the possibility of trying to do something, you know, in relation to what's being called for on the 4th and beyond. But there's this whole idea of in the streets and everywhere and dedicated to actually driving the regime out, you know, and that means the entire regime, not just, you know, have Trump, you know, waddle off to a retirement ranch or something, or even to prison, but actually to have, you know, to get rid of this entire regime, dedicated to driving this regime out. Where do things stand now? Give people an idea of where things stand, because we're going into this thing, opening it up on the 4th. The humanity is going into this, and people need to know where do things stand right now, and how's it look? What needs to happen?
Okay, yeah, let me go there. I just want to come back to this one other point when you were talking about people are swayed by we're really the majority, and they're calculating numbers. And there's the point that I made that they could suspend and change the voting districts, change the laws, suspend laws, and it could be too late anyway. But there's also the fact that people should recognize that fascist regimes are always a minority in the beginning, and actually for some time. South Africa was a fascist state under apartheid, and it was ruled by a minority. This is always the case. The Nazis were actually a minority, okay? But the rest of society goes along with this. And also part of how they do that is they echelon how they do their attacks, and it doesn't affect everyone, and if you go along, you can actually get along. This is how you have that understanding that we should not be good Germans, meaning the good Germans who actually may believe they didn't know what was happening. Well, I'll say right now, people do know. So where are we at with November 4th? We are on track, but not on track. Okay, we're on track in the sense that the day has been called. There's 13 cities have called it. We have a really powerful call for November 4th, which you can get at refusefascism.org. There's an organization. There's people getting involved. There's a brochure that we've put out that have indictments of this regime. It looks like a newsprint edition that says this nightmare must end. The Trump Prince regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist mayor. There's a tremendous number of facts of what the regime has already done, what they're planning to do, and what have they inspired on the state level, since that's how a lot of the laws get passed in the U.S. in the state level. And starting this weekend, we're going to have a available, it's not from Refuse Fascism, it's from revcom.us, there's and Revolution Books in New York. We're going to be putting out there's a film of a talk that Bob Avakian gave recently that goes into why and how this regime needs to be driven out, and that will be available on Sunday. And so we have a lot of the materials, we have the analysis, and now what's needed is you, the people listening to this show. We need many, many more people staffing the offices in the different cities, spreading the word. The word is not out on what November 4th is. November 4th is the day that thousands of people need to be out in the street, marching through the streets, and then vowing to and actually committing to continue where every day people are out in the streets protesting in different cities. And this builds, and it starts with thousands, and it starts with a couple dozen cities, and then it grows to its 10 more cities, 20 more cities. To protests grow from thousands to tens of thousands, where many different social forces from many different points of view are taking to the streets and saying, this must stop now. The Trump-Pence regime must go, where people are stopping thinking along the lines that they're being told to think in of just wait, there's good people going to take care of this for you. In the meantime, the danger of war ratchets up, where people are saying, no, this is intolerable. We have to act. We're not going to wait for you to act. You know, and this is the kind of thing that has to happen that then puts that kind of societal pressure on those in power to actually begin to deal with this. Because as of now, not a single senator have talked about impeachment. Okay, very few in Congress have talked about it. And it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And frankly, if it did happen on this basis, you'd end up with Pence. And that's not any good. In fact, in some ways, it's worse. So you need to actually get the kind of movement in the streets that's saying this whole thing has to end, and it's going to only end if we take this kind of action.
Mm-hmm. All right. On that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I look forward to talking to you again soon, man. We got to keep up on this, all right?
That would be great.
All right, okay. Andy. Thanks
a
lot,
care,
man.
Michael.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. All right. So now we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So talk to you in a minute.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before the war.
It's Bibles, come get your Bibles, guns and flags. Yeah, we got Bibles, come get Bibles, guns and flags. Yeah, it's the Bible.
All right, welcome back. Once again, that was Sonny Meadows with Bibles, Guns, and Flags. And you're going to have to keep hearing that song. The worse things get, the more we're going to have to hear that song, all right? That's just how I feel right now. I interviewed George Prochnik. He's a writer, and he has an article in the February 6th edition of the New Yorker magazine. And his article was When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, according to Stefan Zweig. And he wrote this, and he said, You know, he looked at, in the 1930s, Stefan Zweig, as I said earlier, was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934. He was in exile. And in 1941, he went into exile in the States, in the U.S. He spent the final months of his life furiously writing a memoir. And the memoir was a warning to the people of the future, all right? And he had learned firsthand what it meant to not take on fascism when it first arises, what the consequences are. So without any further ado, we're going to listen to this interview I did with George Prochnik. Check this out. I recently read a piece in The New Yorker. It was a very powerful piece, and it was called When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, according to Stefan Zweig, and it was by George Prochnik. When I read it, I thought, I've got to talk to George. I've got to have him on the show to talk about this because it is such a compelling piece and it's such a necessary and important piece today, given what's going on in the world. So I'm really happy to welcome George to the show. George, I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks so much for having me on and for what you said about the piece.
Well, let's jump into this. You recently wrote a piece in The New Yorker about the Austrian writer Stefan Zweig and his memoir, The World of Yesterday, that he wrote in the summer of 1941. Tell people who Zweig was and why his memoir was so significant that you felt you had to write about this.
Well, Zweig was an affluent Austrian Jew. He grew up in Vienna at the height of its cosmopolitan glamour. He himself, from a very early age, decided that his vocation was writing and was successful immediately. He began writing poetry, then he was writing essays for newspapers, and everything that he did found an audience. He began then writing extremely popular short stories, political essays, eventually histories, a novel, biographies, a libretto, a play. Everything that Zweig did added to his worldly acclamation, and he saw himself, because he became so popular, not just within Austria, but in fact worldwide. And at the pinnacle of his career in the mid-1920s, he was the most widely translated author in the world and quite possibly the most successful. He saw himself as representing all the values of humanism that he hoped the historical trends were going to affirm more and more as his life went on. The first, of course, terrible blow to this dream was the First World War, which shattered the original Habsburg Empire balance between different ethnic groups, which was a vexed balance, but one which, at least for a period of time, kept the worst aspects of prejudice and ethnic denigration in check. After that war, Zweig decided that more important to himself than being a celebrity author would be the project of doing what he could to promote tolerance, international humanism, etc. And even though he continued to write at an extraordinarily prolific rate, he spent even more time, arguably, organizing different conferences, giving talks, trying to bring together the leading humanists from everywhere, from the East as well as from the West, to talk about what could be done to ensure that the catastrophe of the First World War was not repeated. So throughout this time, leading up to the rise of fascism in the late 20s and early 30s, before Hitler actually came to power, Zweig felt that his own situation, despite his grave concern for other more vulnerable populations, that his own situation was relatively immune. And, of course, after the Nazis came to power and eventually Austria as well, later in the 1930s, became threatened and collapsed and fell under Nazi rule, Zweig found himself suddenly among the refugee population that he had watched with compassion and with a terrible sense of premonition, dating way back to after 1933 when Hitler became chancellor. So after he himself left Austria, he went to England and then he went to the United States and eventually he ended up in Brazil. But in the United States, he did the bulk of work on his memoir in the summer of 1941, living in, of all places, a small town up the Hudson from New York City called Osnig. He lived in a house, a very modest house, not like the grand apartments and grand hotels in which he had spent most of his life, very close to Sing Sing prison. And he worked furiously on this memoir because he wasn't trying so much to preserve a record of his private existence. It says virtually nothing about his own domestic life. What he was trying to do was to look at what had happened to his generation and understand how even someone as privileged as himself, let alone the millions, without all the buffers that he had thought would barricade him against the worst effects of fascism, how those had all fallen away. So the document, what he ended up producing in an incredibly rapid rate, he was sometimes writing several hundred pages in a shorter period of a few weeks. What he ended up producing is this extraordinary, I guess we would say, almost a record in real time of how a civilization which had seemed so secure and so invested in its progressive democratic values could have collapsed so utterly and in a relatively short period of time. He really tries to look at this, and I am convinced, having spent a great deal of time with this book, that there are lessons which are sadly very pertinent for us today.
That was one of the really important points that you made in this article. This whole idea of even the title of the book, The World of Yesterday, and he's speaking to an audience that clearly it's not an audience that was necessarily living in the time that he was writing about and was actually looking to the future. And if he actually could conceive of a future given what was going on in the world at the time and what the future might be. But that whole idea of speaking to people about what actually, this is a warning. This is a warning to the future. And I thought this, the point that he made is that it's a law of history that contemporaries are denied a recognition of the early beginnings of the great movements which determine their times. If you look throughout history, that has so much importance in seeing how things develop and how things get to the point that they get to.
That's absolutely correct. Everything that you just said. First of all, in terms of the book as a message to the future, I think he literally conceived of it as a kind of message in a bottle to the future. He knew that his own generation was going to be immersed in, as he said, the abyss and unspeakable hells for as long ahead in time as he himself at the age of 60 when he was composing this could see, or 59 and about to turn 60. But at the same time, he didn't think that the Nazis would ultimately destroy the planet. What he felt was that if there was anything that he could give to allow the next generation to rebuild civilization on sounder grounds, that there could be no higher mission he could take on. To your point where you mentioned how it's denied to contemporaries to see what will become the great or the most important movements of their time, this is something that Zweig very, very poignantly presents. When Hitler first began to make a name for himself, which was in the early 1920s, nobody took him seriously because he seemed a buffoon, uneducated, so crude and ultimately unlikable that the elite, the intellectuals, couldn't imagine that this person would ever become a threat to the entire German, Austrian, and ultimately global culture. You know, there's another scene that I think of in this context. The son of the writer Thomas Mann, Klaus Mann, who was also an author, described having seen Hitler early on at a Munich tea house. And he's watching Hitler stuff his face with these cream puffs, and he's, as he puts it, such a petty bourgeois pig and so nasty and so, in a visceral way, not a leader, not a figure who seems capable of inspiring the urge for greater German glory or let alone any kind of preserving any ideals of civilization. He says, this man can never be a threat to us. And he says, it's impossible. And I think in our own situation here, it's obviously the case that Trump had been around for many years in the public eye. No one who was in a position to stop him understood for a very long time that he might be capable of channeling some sort of mood of a large swath of the country that could ultimately sweep him into power.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You know, one of the things that comes up, too, in your piece, and I thought it really made me pause, because at the same time as what you're talking about in terms of Zweig and what he began to understand, when he actually was out there, at one point, he even ended up applauding the Nazis for their ability to bring, I think you say, a renewed sense of passion and import to German elections. And I kept thinking about the whole idea that somebody can get in there and mix it up, and really the idea is to get people, set people's heads on fire, and then you can actually get in there and wrestle with some things. But this was a fairly stunning thing to see see somebody who did care the way he cared about what was going on, and then at the same time to be sort of blindsided by this whole point of the Nazis had an ability to bring a renewed sense of passion and import to the German elections.
I think that's a very important point. And again, there are certainly people who looked on, who continue to look on. I've seen this phrase in a number of relatively mainstream conservative essays and sites now, but the idea that, well, what this president is doing is acting like a bull in the china shop. You know, we had a huge problem. Something had to happen. He's there. He's going to shake things up. And there's this almost sly little winking, joking sense that they're going to know how to rein this force in at the right time. And historically speaking, the idea that you can control a charismatic maverick at the moment you decide it's gone too far has just been disproven time and again. And I think we have to be very clear that the passions the leader can excite, even though those passions may have different motivations and be from all sorts of different demographics with different goals in mind, they don't in any way validate the larger platform on which a charismatic leader runs. The passions may be real and sincere and have positive elements. That doesn't make anything that the leader himself represents something that we as a country can abide by.
And that's extremely important. I mean, again, you look at what's going on today and think about this. I mean, all the things that we got in the build-up to the election where it was like, look, the people from the Rust Belt are really coming forward. And it was this whole people who haven't voted, people who've been so alienated from the system. Mm-hmm. And finally, they found their hero. And when I'm reading your piece, I'm thinking, damn, it's like way too much. There's way too much similarity here.
Right. There were so many reasons to be skeptical that he would be a hero of those demographics who felt forgotten, disenfranchised, etc. I mean, beginning, of course, with his vast wealth and his notorious lack of generosity as a human being in every sense. But he said what people wanted to hear. And, I think another point that Zweig makes, though, that's relevant, because it's obvious that vote is the Trump's words of, the forgotten man, that mattered. But another thing that Zweig points out about Hitler's ascendancy, at the moment when he himself, Zweig himself, began to take Hitler seriously, was when he realized how much money was being spent on the different squads of young men that he saw training in these towns along the Austrian-German border. They would be driving new trucks, wearing these spanking new uniforms, and all very, very well healed in their appearance. And he realized that there were financial interests using the nascent Nazi Party as a front. And there was unquestionably also a great deal of moneyed interest behind Trump, and that shouldn't be lost sight of. And moneyed interests who have, since the election, however they voted, come to decide, well, maybe this can work in our favor after all. I mean, a friend was telling me recently of a friend of his who is involved with a hedge fund that made hundreds of millions of dollars in the initial weeks after Trump's election. Obviously, there's this enormous rally on Wall Street. So there has also been an acceptance of the more heinous, from the point of view of human rights, actions taken by the administration. I think, unfortunately, because the greed of people with money is so far still being gratified. So it isn't only that this one population found its hero, it's that another population found someone who would allow them to become that much richer and, in fact, increase the very socioeconomic inequalities that in some way made this president possible.
Now, let's move into this, because you say in your piece that Zweig recognized the crucial role of propaganda in eroding the conscience of the world at the time, and this was a massive boon to what Hitler was trying to do. Let's talk about that, because there seems to be a lot you can draw between that situation with Hitler and Trump.
Well, absolutely. One point that Zweig makes is that at the outset of the First World War, it was still possible for a poet, for an intellectual, for an eloquent voice to intervene in the clamor towards war and make a statement that even if it didn't halt the progress towards war, would at least cause enough of a controversy, enough of a dissension within that rush into bloodshed, that there was some hope that you could affect the course of history by sufficiently articulating the dangers of what lay ahead. But over the course of that war, what modern propaganda, what we think of as modern propaganda, really took hold and saturated all forms of media, not just print media, but radio as well. And Zweig documents to an extent how the very capacity to exaggerate the fear of strangers, the dangers posed by foreigners, became a self, not just self-perpetuating, but an expanding, snowballing phenomenon, so that by the end of the war, he actually labeled what the press was doing as the doping of excitement, that there was just a need to produce a certain kind of effect on readers or listeners so that you would continue to have what we would today call an audience share. By the time the Second World War was becoming more and more imminent, Zweig says that the organization of lies, which is how he describes propaganda, had become so effective that it was no longer possible for anyone to say anything that could have the slightest effect on the rush into the madness that that terrible war became. And there were so many eloquent statements in the period leading up to our own election period. I think of Michelle Obama's rightly celebrated speech at the DNC convention and any number of other instances that if it was possible for words to matter to the whole population, they would have mattered at those moments. And unfortunately, it's obvious that our segmented news, our ability to curate our own news feeds through social media, our lack of any common standard of truth has led to a situation in which propaganda is now seen as by one side or the other, and I would argue infinitely more perniciously on the side of the right, it is now viewed as just the situation with news. You're looking for an affirmation of your opinion, not for some sort of a factual report. And in that situation, I don't know how you find common ground again.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. Well, one of the things, too, though, that is very, very important in relation to all this is the fact that propaganda has that other role, which is, as you point out, is both actually whips up Hitler's base. That's what it did in Germany. It whipped up his base. And it covered for some of the most brutal things that he was doing as he was consolidating his hold on power. And that people actually didn't see the truth. They were blurred into wishful thinking. Truth was blurred into wishful thinking, even as all these terrible things were going on.
Absolutely. The combination, as you just said, of how propaganda can hide from people what's actually going on and stir sentiments to encourage the worst excesses. We've seen that. And we've also seen the last point that you made about how in a situation where everything feels so chaotic and dangerous, any gesture towards normalcy becomes something that people just grasped for desperately. And there was that long period in the run-up, both after the election and the period leading up to the election, when I felt as if Trump had only to not do anything awful for 24 hours, 36 hours, and you have extraordinary statements on the part of CNN where it began to sound as though this was a clear indication that he had converted and become just like any other politician. It took so little for people to want to project so much onto any sign that things were not going to be as disastrous as many people feared.
I have two more questions for you, and one is a question that you pose in the article, which is how far along the scale of moral degeneration Zweig would judge America to be today under Trump?
Well, I think that one heartening phenomenon here has obviously been the strength of the resistance to all sorts of different measures that have been promulgated by the White House. That has been the marches, the boycotts have shown that the population is hardly subdued. And there are lots of positive signs of people's understanding that this has to sustain itself and build momentum. One thing that is clear about Trump's character is that he is capable of being thrown off balance. And I say only slightly tongue-in-cheek that I wish that some of the energy of the Occupy movement might turn into a pre-Occupy Trump movement. And I think this could take all sorts of different forms. More boycotts, strikes, obviously marches. Every possible effort to disrupt his own effort to give a veneer of everydayness to what is in fact a radical politics. So that's the good sign. I think in terms of where we are with news, where we are in terms of doubts about the checks and balance in our government, what's the sweep that the GOP had on every level, not just in terms of Congress, but in terms of the governorships, etc. Things are a lot rockier, particularly because the GOP has shown itself to be so absolutely spineless. The point that Zweig makes is that you can have that particularly dangerous equation of eroded shared values and eroded institutions, and things might still not tip all the way over until something catastrophic happens. In the case of Germany, less than 30 days after Hitler became chancellor, that was the Reichstag fire, the burning of the parliament building, which the Nazis blamed on the communists, and which there remains some doubt about today as to whether that might not in fact have been set by the Nazis themselves. But regardless, once that happened, Hitler immediately imposed a raft of emergency measures that shut down justice entirely. And what I worry about here is the big event, whatever form it takes, or the fabricated big event, but something that becomes an excuse. And we've already seen Trump manufacture terrorist incidents, manufacture the threat posed by different demographics in ways that could really spin things very quickly into a different place than we find ourselves in today.
Mm-hmm. Now, you answered a good part of my next question, but I'm going to read the last sentence in your article, and you can comment on it. You say the excruciating power of Zweig's memoir lies in the pain of looking back and seeing that there was a small window in which it was possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly and irrevocably that window can be slammed shut. That's sort of what you were just talking about now, but it's also something that really needs to be emphasized because, frankly, I'm really happy to see all of the resistance that's out in the streets, and we need, you know, there is a need for a whole hell of a lot more. There needs to be millions of people in the streets, millions and millions, to actually speak to the towering, you know, horrible situation that exists today. But I thought your last sentence really puts out a very sharp warning to people, a small window in which it's possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly it can be slammed shut.
Thanks, and I agree with you that what's happened so far, there needs to be more of it, and unfortunately, there's not going to be an opportunity to tire of it. This is not something that is going to go away quickly. In a best case scenario, I think there's a fight here that's going to have to be waged for a long time, and it's been heartening to see that enough Americans have a spirit of defiance of injustice, that they're willing to break up the routines of their own lives and speak out against what's going on. But we need more of it, and I really hope that the different groups, not only vulnerable, but different groups with different kinds of privilege, can find ways of resisting together, because it's only in a very powerful and relentless co-resistance that we're going to keep that window open long enough to actually get these people out of power.
All right. Thank you very much, George. I want to really express my appreciation for the article and for coming on to the show, too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with George Prochnick. Now, George is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. And it's also, he had an article in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker titled When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig. And that's an don't miss piece. Check that out, all right? Now, before I end the show, I have time for a final thought. Claudia Kunz mentioned an important figure in history, Martin Niemöller, a German clergyman who resisted the Nazis and who later became famous for criticizing himself and other good Germans for waiting too long. Niemöller wrote, "I ask myself again and again, what would have happened if in the year 1933 or 1934, 14,000 Protestant pastors and all Protestant communities in Germany had defended the truth until their deaths. If we had said back then, it is not right when Hermann Göring, a top official in Nazi Germany, simply puts 100,000 communists in concentration camps in order to let them die. I can imagine that perhaps 30,000 to 40,000 Protestant Christians would have had their heads cut off, but I can also imagine we would have rescued 30 to 40 million people, because that is what it cost us." Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party in this country, has written, "There is a place where epistemology and morality meet. There is a place where you have to stand and say, it's not acceptable to refuse to look at something or to refuse to believe something because it makes you uncomfortable. And it is not acceptable to believe something just because it makes you feel comfortable." And we've taken that quote from the book Basics, Chapter 5, Quote 11. That's a critical principle under any circumstances, but it takes on extreme urgency at this particular moment. Fascism has direction and momentum. The time to stop it is now, and that's going to take physical and intellectual courage. Talese and Myridden, Namaki Meche, Ricky John Best, and Micah Fletcher didn't ask to be heroes, but when they found themselves in a situation of choosing between silent complicity or courage in Portland, Oregon, they chose to do the right thing. On a large scale, everyone in this country now faces the same choice. All right, now there's something before we leave that I wanted you to hear, and it's a piece from another speech by Bob Avakian, and it's available on a DVD that's called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And this piece is celebrating and learning from the 100th anniversary of the October Revolution in Russia. Which system, capitalism or communism, is the nightmare for humanity? Check this out.
So here is some of what this person raised in his feedback. They wrote, "People in this society, and probably some people in the room, have all kinds of ideas about communism. Maybe they even say, okay, I'm with you. This world is really fucked up. People suffer in all kinds of ways. There are all these outrages. But people say that communism has just been a horror, a disaster, that maybe it's a good idea on paper, but it has only been a nightmare in practice." And then they went on. "To this, I have a few things to say. First, capitalism, imperialism is the real nightmare for humanity, and it's not even a good idea on paper. Second, where does this idea come from that communism is a nightmare? It comes from the politicians who run this capitalist imperialist system, from the people who decide and control what is and is not taught in the schools, from the media mouthpieces of this system and this system's intellectual hitmen. In other words, from the very people who rule over and enforce this capitalist imperialist system and who have told lie after lie after lie to defend this system. These are the people you're going to trust to tell you about communism?" And then they went on. "All this would be bad enough. But then for the last few decades, even many progressive voices, including those who once knew better, have gotten bamboozled or bullied to the point where they no longer know and speak the truth about communism. And this creates a situation where everybody knows that communism is a nightmare, when in reality, very few people know anything about what communism actually is and what the actual experience of the communist revolution has been." So they go on, "Let's talk about that. And here," they say, "are a few examples I thought of. The contrast between the 10 million children who die every year under this system from starvation and preventable disease and the fact that in socialist China, they had solved the food problem so that everyone had enough to eat within 20 years. So remind me, which system is the nightmare for humanity? Or how about the contrast between the situation for women under this system, the millions who are raped and beaten every year, the extreme degradation and enslavement concentrated in pornography and sex trafficking, up against the unprecedented emancipatory advances for women during the first wave of communist revolution in Russia and China? Remind me again, which system is a nightmare for humanity? Or let's contrast the dominant art and culture of this society, real housewives of this or that, and the all too putrid culture that comes through in way too much of hip-hop and so-called stand-up comedy today, up against the revolutionary art and culture that was brought forward through the Cultural Revolution in China, and the prominent role of women and overcoming women's oppression in that art and culture. Remind me once more, which system is the nightmare for humanity? Or contrast the staggering mass incarceration, especially of oppressed nationalities in this country, up against the steps that were taken in Russia to overcome the oppression of minority nationalities. One more time, remind me which system is the nightmare for humanity?
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that was a clip taken from his DVD, which is BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. Fascism has direction and momentum. Dissent is piece by piece criminalized. The truth is bludgeoned. Group after group is demonized and targeted along a trajectory that leads to real horrors. All of this has already begun under the Trump regime. History has shown that fascism must be stopped before it becomes too late. And each and every one of us has to decide where we stand, what we're going to do. And just one more note before we go out. Remember, November 4th, it begins. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And I want to thank the folks who've worked on this show. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op, Kiana Williams. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Amazing Disgrace, which is basically it's from the World Saxophone Quartet and their album Political Blues.
Amazing Disgrace, when they brought us to this godforsaken place. They raped our mothers, incarcerated our fathers, and stole all the land. But in spite of all that, everything will be okay. And that's a natural fact. But nobody will never, they will never be free until they free me and we.